This is Robert Stark. I am joined here with Alexei Boshchevenko. He was on the show a while back to talk about academic composition. And today we're going to be focusing more on the history of education and what is the primary purpose of education and how it has been used throughout history. Alexei, it's nice having you back on.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
So on our last show, we pretty much went over what you do specifically with your project, academic composition. And I'll have that show. That show will be in the archives. But just can you give, before we move on to the basically go over the history of education, do you want to give kind of a brief summary of what you do with your project, academic composition?
Sure. I am a full-time academic ghostwriter, which means that I provide original academic essays for college students. I'm also an owner of an enterprise that can be colloquially referred to as an essay mill, meaning that I supervise other writers who are also academic ghostwriters. Together, we serve students who, for whatever reason, are unwilling or are unable to complete their own college papers.
So the situation with education, it's obviously gotten a lot more costly than it was, say, 30 or even 20, 30, 40 years ago. And it's basically a major industry. Starting, what is sort of originally education was reserved for the elites of society, and the idea of education for the masses, that everyone should go to college, is a fairly recent phenomenon.
That is correct. And Voltaire, an eminent classical French philosopher, famously said that the masses are to be guided or led as opposed to educated. Throughout the Enlightenment tradition, it was widely assumed that intellectual endeavors are the crafts of the wise. They were never intended to be practiced by the ordinary people. And as he put it well, education was reserved for the elites. Today, such ideas are widely regarded as politically incorrect. They're seen as principles of fascism, elitism, oppression, and whatnot. But one has to ask, are these suspicions really warranted? Did Voltaire really have a point that the masses should merely be guided, that they should not be educated? And the very idea of public education did not even enter the collective American consciousness until the middle of the 19th century, when Senator Horace Mann, a Massachusetts senator, traveled to Prussia and observed the tremendous discipline with which Prussian autocrats were able to mold the minds of their peons. And Helots. And when he came back to the United States, he was not impressed with the idea of helping ordinary people think critically. He had no such thing in his mind. Instead, he wanted to create an institution of intellectual regimentation that rendered the public vulnerable to political manipulation and susceptible to economic exploitation. That was the operating rationale of the man who founded the American system of public education.
So you're talking about Senator Horace Mann. When he traveled to Prussia, his observations on the education system there was that it emphasized strongly on obedience to authority, punctuality, and conformity.
Exactly. He was fascinated by how the schoolmasters would ring a bell and students would rush to class like one. When the teacher would tell them what to do, they would comply without question. And essentially, this philosophy was based on what Horace Mann's contemporary, an eminent Prussian thinker, Johann Fichte, said, that the system of education is designed in such a way that it ensures that the student can think only what his master can tell him to think. That suspends his capacity to carry out moral reasoning, autonomous moral reasoning. His mind becomes subservient to that of the intellectual elite.
So Horace Mann, did he implement an educational system in the United States based on that model?
Exactly. That is the sole reason he visited Prussia, and it should be said that in historical context, this phenomenon was Prussia's defeat to Napoleon. And the Prussian king determined that this was a result of insubordination within the ranks of the military. And that stemmed from the fundamental inefficiency of the system of education to do what it was supposed to do. As you know, not only in the United States, but also in Prussia and the rest of the world, education was reserved for the elites, and the elites were taught to think critically. Yet when these highly educated people took it upon themselves to help other people become educated through volunteering or through private enterprise, they taught them in a way that promoted autonomous initiative. Clearly, this was a mistake that the Prussian leaders sought to correct. Instead of having privatized education that really teaches people to think critically, that they wanted to create a system of massive indoctrination. They did just the opposite of that. And that was
Horace Mann's
inspiration.
It's a more effective strategy because when the elites forbid the masses from having access to education, that would make them vulnerable to, say, a revolution. But education is a way for them to influence the masses and make the masses think that they are being given something rather than being deprived of education, and the masses are more likely to rise up in revolt.
Exactly. Education is, in fact, a public education, rather, is, in fact, a system. The system of social welfare works in the same way that yet another Prussian autocrat, Otto von Bismarck, found. As it is a well-documented fact, Otto von Bismarck founded the welfare state. Rather, he laid down the incipient foundation of such a system, and therein his purpose was to cool the revolutionary ardor of the peasantry by making them think that they are being assisted by the state. This is the same holds true for education. It's a government program that is designed to instill what Marxists call a false consciousness into the minds of the public. And they presume themselves, the citizenry presumes itself to be an ally of the state, when in reality they are becoming chattel that's to be exploited for the political ends of the elites, who very much believe that the masses are to be guided rather than educated.
What are the main reasons that education is so much more expensive today than, say, it was several decades ago? I mean, there was access to education, and the value of a college diploma has vastly decreased.
Well, the laws of basic economics seem to answer that question rather well. If we analyze the quality of education that we receive in purely objective terms, it would appear that the kind of content that we get, the content of intellectual material we get in college, is roughly equivalent to what we received from high school back in the 1970s. Maybe the average person is slightly better off, but that is very much questionable in light of great inflation and the general decline of the academic curriculum. And if we were supplying the same kind of content to the students through the institution of just high school. Obviously, society did not need to spend as much money on that as it now does on four-year institutions all across the board. Today, over 50% of Americans either have a college degree or have attempted to get one. Given that there is so much of a higher demand for a college degree that essentially achieves the same purposes as a high school degree got in the 70s, it shouldn't be very surprising to see that because most people are forced to buy a very expensive service, the colleges will inevitably raise their prices. And what happened? What actually caused this? There is yet again the involvement of the government that needs to be paid close attention to. As you know, President Jimmy Carter founded the Department of Education in the late 70s. This was done with the explicit purpose of rendering college education more available to the general public. One of the provisions of his policies was that the government now had the legal prerogative to provide funding to the disadvantaged students. Throughout the 80s and the 90s, these developments continued to proliferate, and as a result, the government funding has become increasingly more available to students of all kinds. Thus, virtually anybody was able to obtain a college degree, and the laws of basic economics dictate that when customers are able to buy a nearly unlimited supply of a certain commodity, its price will go up. When the supply of clientele and the demand goes up, the supply is going to be much more costly. And that's the reason. The government intervention and the student loan program is truly a pivotal component in this phenomenon of rampant tuition inflation. When adjusted for inflation, the college education now costs four times as much as it did in 1970.
And do you have numbers, or at least if you don't have the specific number, could you give an estimate how much of the money spent on college, revenue spent on college by students goes directly to paying off the interest on the student loans?
That is a very interesting question, and I'm certain that even with some preliminary and cursory research, it should be possible to obtain these numbers. But I do not have them. However, I would estimate this based on what I know about the system of education. A very tiny portion of these student loans is really paid off now. In fact, our collective student debt exceeds our national debt, and our national debt is over $1.2 trillion. Our students owe more money than that. And what is the reason why they're not able to pay off these loans? Well, one reason is that students have little incentive to major in disciplines that are likely to be lucrative. Very few of them want to become engineer in nature. Very few of them have the ability or the dedication to become physicians or medical professionals. Instead, that they buy into the demagoguery that if you have a college degree, say in gender studies or in African-American studies, what have you, you're going to be so much more employable, when in reality this is very far from the truth. What about the college professors and administrators? Do they have any incentive to tell the truth? Well, no, they do not. Because once a student graduates and cannot find a job for their transgender studies degree with a concentration in
homosexual
studies.
Basically, the only
studies,
job you get with one of those degrees is if you become a professor teaching that subject.
Yes, or you can also get a job through affirmative action. You can join the government, or you can fight for the rights of this or that oppressed group, or you can just rely on your personal charisma or other abilities that you would have had without getting that degree in the first place. So that is reality. That's the reason why a significant portion of student loans are rarely paid back at all.
And it's basically the same concept of where you at large businesses have little to fear from government regulation because the elected officials depend heavily on the support from the financial elites, and also they influence the regulations of the government. So it's the same way universities are able to succeed. They're served the same way by public regulations that a large businesses are.
Exactly. I mean, the pivotal concept in this scenario is regulatory capture. In theory, regulations should restrict the avaricious impulses and the self-serving ambitions of corporate executives. But that simply is not happening when these same regulations are written by the lobbyists who finance the campaigns of politicians who are supposed to enforce these regulations. And the universities have lobbyists of their own. They devote an unseemly amount of money to politicians, to political causes, and their representatives who supposedly fight for the quality of education in this country, but they're doing the opposite. The Department of Defense and the pharmaceuticals are known to provide munificent funding to medical departments all across the board. And when we ask, well, why is it that certain pharmaceutical drugs create epidemics? Not epidemics, but create adverse side effects. They don't work. They're supposed to. Thousands of researchers have signed up on them. Well, maybe all the funding the universities took from the pharmaceuticals had something to do with this. And I mean, the military has been actively financing research at universities since the 1960s. That was the cause of a great deal of righteous indignation. The Mario Savio's free speech group raised, and so on and so on. But there was definitely a problem of corporate lobbying, system of education that allows universities to advertise their services in a very duplicitous manner. Every now and then, you turn on the TV and you hear about how a degree from Walden University is what you need, how the University of Phoenix is a wonderful thing. How so many people got the jobs of their dreams from Kaplan. Well, wait a moment. Well, what happened? What happened here is not surprising. Just go on Google.com and look up and enter consumer complaints about Kaplan or consumer complaints about the University of Phoenix. Each and every one of these has a 1 or 1.5 star review in general. And this even goes as far back as the 1980s, when Ronald Reagan deregulated legislation that prohibited duplicitous advertisement, and then the universities took advantage of that. But then again, there are other deeper problems. Even if Ronald Reagan did not do any such thing, The very fact that the universities and political officials are collaborating, that very fact would mean that the academic institutions will find an opportunity to advertise their services in a duplicitous manner.
Yeah, you're talking about the online degree mills, DeVry and the University of Phoenix.
Yeah.
Where basically, are you saying these are bigger scams than the private than the major universities, even more so, or what are
well,
the differences?
It's hard to say who's the bigger scam. On the
everyone, well, basically, yeah, everyone is. So basically, everyone is accepted to them as long as they pay the cost. So very little is expected.
Correct.
In terms of quality.
Right, nothing is expected in terms of quality. And the other day, a friend of mine complained to me about his boss, who was very imposing and imperious at work. So we played a little prank on them. We went on the 5-degree mill science and DeVries, Strayer, Kaplan, Ashford, Phoenix. I just entered his name for all of these schools. The next thing we knew in each and every case was that somebody from these schools would contact him. There was no admission process. There was no screening process. There was no interview. All you need to do was enter your name, and there you go. You're going to get a call from them about starting your first class. In that sense, yes, they're a scam. They have no standards. The academic rigor in these programs is deplorable. But on the other hand, there is no way all of these schools combined will ever defraud nearly as many students as the four-year institution.
Basically, they use the two big angles of this is that the number one objective and purpose of education society is a for-profit industry, but the other factor is to it's a way to mold the future citizens of a society. What are give some examples of how education affects the way people think and what values it teaches them?
Well, if you ask what values it teaches them, you have to go back to Horace Mann, that it teaches conformity, obedience, and general respect for hierarchy. That's the initial premise of education in the 19th century. However, circumstances clearly have changed toward the 20th century. During the progressive era when the Industrial Revolution happened, the system of education shifted gears to help students become more productive factory workers. Or to put it another way, it actually helped the factory owners obtain a more pliable workforce that doesn't question what they were told. That was especially important in light of the fact that the initial immigrants to the United States were very much inner-directed people, as the famous sociologist David Reason explained in his classic, The Lonely Crowd. And given that the initial immigrants to America were much more resilient and independent and inner-directed than most people, they would not take orders as easily as with the average European. So in the late 19th century, the educators endeavored to correct that. Yet after World War II, as the progressive scene developed further, it became more important for educators to lead students to think in a more liberal, a more leftist perspective. These changes began taking root prominently in the 1960s. That is when the universities began becoming a political bastion of the left sphere of influence.
Ideally, how do you personally see what should ideally the purpose of education be, as opposed to how it is now?
I think there should be no public education at all. It is a fool's errand. It's simply a fact that in order to advance in any intellectually challenging craft, one needs to be either talented or dedicated. And clearly, most students have little interest in academic undertakings. Very few students are above average in intelligence. Well, most students are average, in fact. But which would mean that if they are average, they would need to devote a serious effort to become a well-educated. And that's something that most of them are not able to do. There is absolutely nothing wrong with just going back to the time before Horace Mann institute a compulsory education for everyone. Even before that, the majority of Americans were able to get some kind of private education, and that was the problem. The problem was not that the majority of Americans were not educated at all. The problem was that they were educated in a way that did not serve the interests of the state. So let's just go back to that point of possible, which probably isn't possible, but there, and just set up the system of education to work in a way that it did, and always did for the elite, meaning that the standards are going to be rigorous and challenging. It's going to be a sink or swim time. Students who pass are free to stay, and who fail, well, no government is going to force them to stay in school if they fail. The very notion of the no child left behind really epitomizes Horace Mann's initial intention behind the creation of the system of public education. What it essentially means is that no child is going to be left behind who isn't properly indoctrinated. It's clear that the George Bush had little regard for academic standards, and that's the way it goes with government institutions of all kinds. Once the government compulsorily creates a system that encompasses everybody in it, nobody has any resources, has any recourse against poor quality. They just have to accept it and grin and bear. So that has to change. The compulsory education has to be done away with, just as the compulsory military service was.
So in the past, well, it was common that you would have like a trade, or you'd have a business that was passed down through generation, and each people would learn a specific skill or trade. And mm-hmm. I guess that in hindsight, that system worked a lot better. But what's going on now is you have these students that are basically have like $100,000 in debt, and they're working like low wage jobs.
Mm-hmm. So their grandfather spent their time wisely. They identified their natural talents, or at least something they could do reasonably well, and they spent time practicing it. If somebody's father was a plumber, well, maybe the son and the grandson will have enough natural talent to be a plumber, and that's what they did. But on the other hand, now there are a lot of people in college who have the potential to be talented entrepreneurs, talented craftsmen, or they could pursue any number of trades that they don't even know exist yet. Yet now they're being manipulated into taking college classes that have nothing to do with their true value to society. They're not actualizing their potential anymore. As long as the system of compulsory education continues, and if it continues to manifest in the mainstream media as the incarnation of higher education, essentially higher education is now seen as mandatory. Anybody who does not obtain a college degree is left to believe that they have no chance in obtaining a well-paying job, but that is nonsense. In fact, there is a shortage of skilled tradesmen. And if more people stop going to college and instead pursue these trades, chances are that there will not be as much of a shortage, and more people will have the opportunity to contribute to the well-being of society in general.
You touched on this briefly, but how does the corporate environment, the culture of the corporate environment, mimic the environment of education and how education prepares people for that corporate environment?
Well, you've got to ask, when most students graduate from college, where are they most likely to be working? Are they going to go into the manual trades, such as the back of the oil field? Are they going to become plumbers? I don't think so. Are they going to start their own businesses? Well, some might, but that's a tiny minority. Are they going to go work for small businesses? Maybe. But the majority of them are going to end up in an institution that Noam Chomsky refers to as the state corporate nexus. And it's the same as the ancestor of the state corporate nexus that laid down the foundation of Horace Mann's strategy for the creation of public education. Therein is when the students have to graduate and a mindset that makes them pliable to whatever directives or dictates they'll receive, and then a government or a large corporation. These employers have little interest in students who can think. They're much more interested in the students who are obedient or conformist and are willing to do what is asked of them. In fact, this goes back to David Riesman's classic, The Lonely Crowd. Well, therein he explained that by 1945, the general American mindset shifted away from the traditional inner-directed mindset to the other-directed mindset, meaning by then, most people have become much more interested in simply living their lives the way others tell them to, as opposed to finding their own way. And this, I believe, is the crowning achievement of the system of education. This is its ultimate outcome. So to answer your question about how the corporation and governments, how the government and corporations mimic the culture of higher education, I'd say that they don't really mimic each other. The general culture of the state of the government and the corporations, the bureaucracy, it is what created the system of education. The system of education was modeled after a standard bureaucracy.
And you wrote this essay, and you also talked about Friedrich Nietzsche. And Nietzsche regarded Christianity as a slave morality, and he held that religious institutions exacerbated the worst excesses of feudal authoritarianism. So are you saying you basically, then this was basically before modern education, but are you saying that you basically agree with his assertions?
Well, I'm not sure which assertions specifically have in mind, but there is a good point that Christianity contains elements of slave morality. That was Friedrich Nietzsche's argument, that the religious leaders throughout history, throughout the Middle Ages, have been known to closely collaborate with the political leaders. It wasn't uncommon for the Pope of the Catholic Church to have close ties with royalties all across the Holy Roman Empire. And that's how Christianity was manipulated as a system of subordination all across Europe. And it wasn't surprising at that point either that the Catholic leaders often played a key role in providing the public education that was available. There was no state bureaucracy, but the elites are educating the masses. While they may have made an effort to indoctrinate the public, they did not do so in a centralized and a skillful of a manner as the public sector bureaucrats would have. Yet that was exactly the reason why Horace Mann saw the need for a more centralized system of indoctrination. And here's why it proved to be even more relevant in the late 19th century, when Horace Mann actually took upon this endeavor. As you know, Friedrich Nietzsche died in 1900. He published his most distinctive works in the late 19th century. In the 1860s and 1870s, Horace Mann traveled to Prussia in 1865. And there, at this exact time period, Nietzsche observed that God was dead, meaning that the people ceased to believe in God as fervently as they used to. And now, they're by this time, they're much more likely to question the slave morality of Christianity. So this poses a significant crisis for the elites in America and Europe. Because of the death of God, the elites are now scrambling to create a new system of indoctrination that must be as potent and pervasive as Christianity has been for centuries. And only and amazingly, it took the elites only, well, 70 or 60 years, between 1870 and 1880, and until 1940, they managed to create a system of public education that finally shifted the collective mentality of Americans from the inner-directed perspective to the other-directed. So, in short, the conventional religion of Christianity that imposed slave morality upon Europeans and Americans was replaced by the civil religion of the left that takes root in the conventional system of education.
So the modern left is obviously hostile to what they see as a traditional Christianity, but you do see a lot of the same tactics that are used today that were used by the church in the past.
Exactly. For example, the modern left excoriates heretics, any scholar who suggests that people in welfare are somewhat responsible for their plight. Any scholar who what have you implies that homosexuality or transgender may not be entirely transgender, behavioral traits may not be entirely genetic, there might be a choice, is obviously going to be excommunicated. Anybody who challenges the leftist economics or suggesting that FDR was less than a hero will obviously be a pariah, and so on and so on. The left has its own dogmas and high priests who guard them with missionary zeal.
Where do you see things heading in the future? What trends do you see? I mean, the big issue now is there's more people with college degrees, or college degrees have dramatically increased. But there are more, unemployment is increasing. What are some of the big trends that you predict that will be over the course of the next several decades?
Well, I would say that the drastic changes are rather unlikely to occur because the system of education's current state is deeply entrenched in the public mind. It's going to be very difficult, if not altogether impossible, to convince the citizenry that they should rethink their commitment to colleges, that maybe they should not go into a debt of $60,000 to get a women's studies degree. Maybe they should not get that PhD for $300,000. Or maybe that the quality of education is so deplorable that it's just not worth the time to keep on bothering with it. That's not going to happen. What is happening now is that we have 91.5 million working-age Americans who are not even looking for a job. That is correct. People who Google this, look it up, 91.5 million, I mean the ages of 18 and 64, are not only unemployed, they have no interest in finding any work at all. Now, why is that? Well, because maybe they should have thought twice about getting their transgender studies degree. So that's going to continue. And what we see happening now is that when four-year institutions are becoming less accessible to the general public, as adults just don't have time to go to class and sit in the same room with a bunch of 18 and 19-year-olds who are hungover, then instead that they want to take online classes. And this is where the four-year tough for you are the online degree mills come into play. The baby boomers have all graduated, so now they want to target these same baby boomers again. Now that we're getting these, this onslaught of students of no interest in learning, there are more degree mills that are very happy to defraud their customers. That's why these institutions have a one-star review on the customer complaint internet forums to compete with these institutions. And here is the scary part. The four-year schools are becoming increasingly more like these online degree mills. Universities such as George Mason University, University of Michigan, University of Georgia, and so on and so on. They continue to offer more online classes so they can compete for students instead of letting these degree mills have them. So what we're going to have is more and more students taking useless classes where they do not learn a thing. And here is the reason for it. It's classes that are known to be educated, they're known to be intellectually rigorous, have two things in common. They have competent pedagogues, and they have low teacher-student ratio, which means the competent pedagogues can engage in private discourse with students. That's how they learn. Obviously, that goes out the window in an online classroom. That's going to continue. The quality of education will decline. There will be more students going into the job market, who are going to be caught like deer in the headlights, have no concept of what it takes to survive in the real world, and I would not be surprised if 20 years down the road we're going to have 110 million people, working age people, who are not looking for a job. That means that we're going to have well over one-third. Today, the population of the United States is 330 million. About 300 million are working age. We already have almost one-third of the population that is completely unemployable. It's going to get worse. And the only thing we can hope for is that there will be a crisis that is severe enough to force a reform of the system of education, but not severe enough to run the economy into the ground. And one reason I remain optimistic about academic ghostwriting is that it might raise awareness of how far gone our education in this country really is. And once that happens, the public will begin demanding real reforms. But that goes back to what I said in our last interview, how academic ghostwriting as a strategy of tension.
So you see it as a way to subvert the system. I guess some of your,
yeah.
I mean, but I'm sure you have critics say what you do is ethically wrong, but you see it as a way of subverting the system. But how specifically does academic ghostwriting subvert the system?
Well, can you imagine the expression on the faces of idealistic parents whose 18-year-olds are about to go to college? What if we tell them that their chances, their children's chances of finding a service like ours are high, and they're going to be using it? In fact, I've met people whose kids are going to college now, and they ask me, well, do you think it's likely that my daughter or my son will be using the services like yours? And then I have to tell them, you've got to take this seriously. What you want to do is make sure that your children are interested in learning, and they pick a discipline that keeps them focused on a long-term objective. And they have no such interest. They're going to end up as my customers or the customers of somebody else who's much less qualified. And imagine what would happen if every single parent in America knew about this. Do you think they think twice about sending off their kids to Flutter? I imagine that they would begin demanding that colleges cut away these ridiculous classes that are so easy to cheat through. They're going to start demanding smaller student ratio, and they'll start protesting against the McDonaldization of higher education. And that these are the specific ways in which the strategy of tension will create demand for real reforms. If you look at the implementation of strategy of tension in the historical context, you can consider Italy and Greece in the 60s and the 1970s. The right-wing leaders of the military juntas in these countries often deliberately planted terrorist attacks across the country just to make the public demand a stronger state that is capable of dealing with these attacks. So the same goes for academic ghostwriting and education. Now, we're infiltrating the system and hopes that sooner or later the demand for real education will rise. Sooner or later, we're hoping that academic ghostwriting will achieve a scenario where its own non-existence will be necessary.
Could you point to academic models and say other parts of the world that you would see as models worth emulating?
It's really hard to say. It's hard to say if there are models worth emulating. But one thing I'm noticing is that Great Britain is a much more difficult market for academic ghostwriters. They do have essay mills as well. For example, essay writer Cole UK is a multi-million-dollar company in England, but there are not as many companies out there. When I've marketed in England, I only got a few customers, and that's because the majority of students in England do not work nearly as much as Americans do. And it's also more difficult for British adults to attend college. They're just not into that as much. For example, when I get British students, they're often unable to afford my services. And when I do get their papers, their assignments are always much more challenging. Standards are clearly higher. I could tell the professors read those papers from start to finish. And for one, their papers are also longer. So I think Britain may be worth emulating. Their system of education is not ideal, but they're doing one to two things right. But their standards are higher in the universities. And they're not encouraging incompetent students to attend their institution. Hell, even Canada is better off. In my experience, Canadian students are clearly brighter than the American students, and their standards are more rigorous. So clearly, the step towards the degree mills is a step in the wrong direction in countries that have not been consumed by the online class epidemic are in a much better shape because of that.
Because, the culture in education is that everyone is to get as many people as possible to get as many people as possible into education, but the irony is you have these kind of two political forces. On one end, you have people who say that in order to have a more egalitarian society, you need to have as many people as possible in education. But on the other hand, it's leading to a situation where you have large numbers of people who are broke and unemployed, and they're basically being exploited by the financial elites, where income inequality has gotten much worse than in the past when less people had college degrees. There was greater income equality.
Right. There was greater income equality because more people had opportunities to gain skills that would allow them to command a respectable wage. I mean, in the 1950s or 1960s, if a certain man who's not cut out to be academically educated becomes a plumber or becomes a skilled tradesman, he would be much more likely to command a reasonable wage. But now, No, he wastes his time going $60,000 into debt to obtain a gender studies degree. That he is going to be much more likely to end up in the dregs of society. He's going to be much more likely to end up without any employable prospects. This notion of how wealth inequality is to be bridged through a provision of education to as many people as possible belies a fundamental misunderstanding of basic economics. And it also reveals the misunderstanding of the fact that not credentials, but skills is what empowers one to command a higher wage. And until the general public understands this, industries like mine will continue to flourish with more and more people getting useless degrees that are to leaving them completely unemployable. That is why we have 91.5 million people, working age people, not looking for a job. And I will say that again, 91.5 million working age people in this country have given up all hope on finding a job. That is almost one in three. Now, that's going to get much, much worse until the stupidity of education for all is cured once and for all.
That was Alexei Boshchevenko. I'd like to thank you for being on the show.
Thank you very much.
That's all we have for today's show, so take care, and we'll be back with you next time.